All right. The small council adjourns. The king is dead.
King is dead. Long
Last
live the
word of the
king.
queen. Queen. Boo.
Yeah, well, yeah,
Team
queen,
black.
definitely. I don't want the rapist on the on the throne, but you know, he got the first
Well,
crown.
you have to be more specific.
Which one?
I don't know where to begin. Okay, so I'll
You gotta begin
start with
somewhere.
the thing that we
Start a
kind of
big
mentioned a
council.
little bit in the chat, the beast beneath the boards, right? Now, Jenny, you said that the dragon coming in at the end is probably not the beast beneath the boards, right?
Yeah,
I
I think it's a
agree.
bit too blatant. I think it's like the other part of it is like it doesn't quite fit because the dragon pit is made out of stone. So if we're going with literal beast beneath the boards, the dragon pit arena and the dragon pit caverns are all stone. So there isn't anything beneath the boards because there wouldn't be any boards. So my current theory, and I've got a couple of things to support it, actually quoted, is Helena, who's been saying it all the way through, specifically at the point where Alicent was going to tell her some important news about the king being dead that had to be kept a secret. She was going to share a secret, and it was like, "Don't touch me." And there's a beast beneath. Like it was like a shh. There's a beast beneath the boards. So I think it's more about spies and little, like you know, the whispering. You know, all of the undercurrents of spy work that's happening in the castle. And specifically, she was embroidering a spider, and also specifically, Varys called the white oh my gosh, the spy mistress's like spies, particularly the maid. She said, "One of the spiders is one of your ladies."
Right.
To Alicent. So Alicent's serving maid, who has been outed as a spy for the White Worm, has been described as a spider, while Helena was embroidering a spider, while Helena was talking about the beast beneath the boards. So that
Right.
is my current running theory, that it's more about her being very scared and paranoid about in-castle spies than it is about literally a dragon bursting out from the ground. But that's I'm willing to concede. If there is nothing that comes more forward than what is currently popped forward.
Well, so the handmaid being Talia. Well,
Yeah.
that's interesting. Because I still think that it ties in with the that it could be the rats, or there could be the spiders, or it could be the
Think it's just the general undertones of all
yeah.
the spies that are happening, because like the White Worm's got spies, Varys has got spies, Otto's using both the White Worm and Varys, and Varys is using Alicent, and there's like weird interconnected networks, and there's so many also insect metaphors. Like Helena
Yeah.
has a thing for insects, and we have Firefly, we have a spider, we have a worm. There's just lots of different
Yeah.
allegories for
Creepy
creatures
crawly.
that, yeah, that creepy crawly and exist that are associated with spies. And then you've got like yeah, it just, I feel like for me, it's about critters that are plotting and spying and undercurrents underneath
Yeah, it
Red
does have
Keep.
this episode like does have a very a secrecy theme because it all starts right with the council and the truth that Alicent tells and their decisions there. So yeah, the whole episode's about things that get out through the cracks, like the truth and the light gets out.
Yeah. Well, talking of the
Yeah.
light getting out, did you guys notice that the serving maid lit the light in the window, which was
Yep.
clearly a signal fire to the White Worm that the king was dead, and
Yep.
that's how she was the
Yeah.
first one to know outside of the walls
There you go.
the king was dead. So
Yeah,
even the light
I did.
gets out.
I didn't
Yeah.
pick up on that.
Yep. That's
That's
what
why
kind
she was
of. No,
lighting all the
it's.
candles in the windows.
It was just one. It was just the one candle, right?
Well, the one window, because
Or the
in
one
order to light
window,
that
yeah.
window, you've got to leak quite a lot of candles, but
Well,
it was
was
just
it
that
one like
one.
candle piece? Didn't it have like four candles on each side or something? Or I think it was just
Was
like one
I think there was a lot of
menorah
candles
looking
in
thing.
that room. So I don't exactly know the type of code that she would have with the White Worm regarding revealing it, but it was literally
Yeah.
one well-lit, bright room in the Red
Well,
Keep that could be
yeah. It was a
seen, and
very, very
those who would know to
somber,
see it.
like a somber beginning too of the episode. It was so like everything was
Yeah.
dark.
I have it in my notes. Lovely atmosphere and credit to the direction, like literally as a direct note, because honestly the cinematography direction of this series has been gorgeous.
Yeah, and also like we see
Waking Castle.
We see some Romain Djawadi classics, namely, whenever there's a big shift in the plot, we hear the piano. And we heard that at the beginning, sort of indicating the change in Monarch. Last time we heard a piano, and correct me if I'm missing any out here, it's the Night King. The Night King's final theme was done by piano. And then before that, I think we heard it with in the song The Light of the Seven, which was when Cersei blew up the Sept. So it's a rarely used instrument in the Game of Thrones soundtrack, but when it is used, I really like the impact it has. I really like the tense atmosphere that it brings, and I think it's used quite well. In fact, I think the score for this entire episode, I think, is my favorite of the series so far, and and all throughout the whole, or most of the episode actually, you saw little slow montagey bits which I thought worked really quite well.
Yeah, a lot of people being alone in rooms thinking about the world, sort of deep thought.
Yeah, and slow pace, because am I right in saying that this episode is called The Greens and then the next episode is called The Blacks? And
it's called The Green Council, and then
the Green Council and the Black Council.
But the Black Queen, I think it's the Green Council and the Black Queen or something like that.
So I think what we could see next week is a like a mirror on Rhaenyra's side.
Yeah, because we didn't see anything.
Which I think I called. Did I call it
you
at the end of last episode?
You did.
It was going to be in one place.
Well done.
Well, I think,
That's what Game of Thrones historically did with episode 9, wasn't it?
Yeah, like the Battle of Blackwater, the Battle of the Bastards, all those episodes where it's just in one location.
Okay, well, we need to give a, all right, we'll present you with your Jenny as Right Award.
Good job.
Jenny Fawcett Award.
Yeah.
I will concede I'm wrong more often than I'm right, but, that was one of the ones I was like, yes!
I mean, you articulated that, pretty well. Like, you didn't get that right by fluke, right? Like, you got that right by, gathering the pace of the plot and working out, how Game of Thrones tells a story. So, fair play, that's talent. The Beast Beneath the Boards could very well be, and it's just a thought, going on what you were saying, Jenny, about the sort of it referring maybe to more of a vibe or more of a the beast beneath the board is the subterfuge and the deception and the spying and the lying and the
so many mixed insect metaphors. Like, again, we've got the spider, we've got the white worm, we've got Laris talks about the queen, like if you kill the queen bee, then the rest of the hive will fall.
Yeah.
We've got Laris has got his fireflies. Just like it feels like the entire, I'm getting that sort of itchy feeling from the number of critter references that are to do with the keep, like that feeling of just bed bugs.
There's bed bugs inside the bed.
Critters everywhere.
There's termites in the foundation.
Exactly. Like it's rotten to the core.
Yeah. Maggots. Lots of maggots So does that mean anything?
It's probably more metaphorical, but...
Ultimately.
I don't know whether or not it means that Helena's just aware of things, and there's a lot of conversation about whether or not she's neurodivergent or just psychic, or whether or not a bit of both, whether or not that's a problematic trope. Or just insightful, or is she naive? I don't know about Helena's stuff. I mean, obviously, you could take in Cassandra of Troy references, like nobody believes her. She's telling the truth and no one believes her. She's saying that there's problems in the foundation and no one listens to her because she's crazy. There's lots of ways to read it. I don't know whether or not it's going to... it'll be interesting to know whether or not it's references a specific incident or a specific person, a specific beast or a specific event involving a person who is a metaphorical beast beneath the boards, or whether or not it is just she is hyper aware that the castle is not safe from secrets. The point where like she was like there's a beast beneath the door, shh, mum, don't tell me things, and then her mum reached out for her and she was like, no, don't touch me. It felt like it might be related to
Alicent then, possibly.
She might know that maybe Alicent has been speaking to the beast beneath the boards, being maybe Laris, the beast who is interested in what stands on the boards. If we're gonna go into that discussion,
I think of Laris as what could be described as the beast beneath the boards, because he seems connected with the rats.
I'm not buying after this episode. I 100% just think that Laris is just a weird dude with a foot fetish.
Well, okay. Maybe, actually. Because I've got to be honest, I was kind of disappointed by how that unfolded, right? Because it's like...
That was not in the book, by the way. That was a surprise.
I mean, it's definitely
that was
probably...
a weird scene.
In terms of... It definitely makes it very memeable, and we were talking about the fact that some of the series has been humorless, and whether intentionally or unintentionally, it's quite funny that's what he's into and that's the payment.
Well, I didn't get the foot thing straight away, right? Like,
it took me took off the second sock to be like, oh.
I thought something might have been going
directed
down.
Directed by Quentin Tarantino.
Or, yeah. Or maybe like it was like a demonstration that she's getting more like comfortable or trustworthy with him. Because to be honest, it's a little bit like on the nose that the guy with the club foot has the foot fetish. Like,
I thought that too.
That doesn't feel like creative writing. And further to that, like what was kind of fun was working out Laris's like motivations and goals. And I don't want this to be the thing that motivates him to see, he's got this foot fetish and
the ankle.
Yeah, what's the top of the foot fetish pyramid? The queen's feet.
The queen's feet.
No, you know, like, is that it? No.
Who was it who put the meme with the hand and the foot with Alicent and Otto?
Stacey.
Memes. There's gonna be so many. Oh yeah. I saw that. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yes. I'm starting to think that Laris kind of only has the one trick, and that's burning things down.
He has no lineage at all, right? So he is totally his default.
He's the end of his line.
His temptation is to just throw stones and mess everything up, right?
Well, that's it.
He's the stone caster.
If he wanted to strengthen his family, he presumably wouldn't have killed them. Or would be more interested in maybe marriage to, you know, foster children, etc., right? But he doesn't seem interested in that. He's in fact explicitly said he's not interested in children. So, like, okay, so what is his motivation?
It's just feet.
It can't be faster just feet. Like a rat.
That's so bad writing if it's just feet. I didn't even.
Yeah, what if that's was, just.
It's
what
so
if,
bad writing.
What if his deeds keep getting worse and worse just for feet?
Just for feet. I mean, that's. Because the thing is, I didn't even clock it initially. And I thought, like, for want of a better expression, warming himself up, right? Like, and I thought, this is not usually.
I feel like she could have also, like. Like this is clearly an agreement they've had multiple times. And I feel like she was not really wanting to do it. Like she wasn't really wanting to have sex with Viserys. She didn't really want to show her feet to Laris because she knew that that's what the next step was.
Duty.
And she was kind of just like,
they've been through this before. Fine. This is not the first time this has happened.
Yeah.
Okay. And then she's like, she took off both socks straight away, and I'm like, lady, eke it out a bit. Like, see whether or not he gives some information without taking off the second sock. Like, you know,
what a weird
has to
dance.
Be two. Has
what
to be
weird,
2 feet.
What a weird like dance of information exchange challenge, you know.
And like, but also it
but
does tie in.
Someone with more beautiful feet than
she could have done per toe. She could have like gone one toe at a time.
Oh my god, you guys! Oh my god, the was that line in the episode where she was like nearly trying, she was trying to stab Rhaenyra and she was like, another thing you're crushing under your pretty feet. Maybe that was already happening with her and Laris when she's like, maybe that's why guys like her. She's got such pretty feet. I know, that's nuts. It was just one of those things where I'm like, she literally says the line, like, another thing for you to walk over with your pretty feet to Rhaenyra.
Feet are on the mind. Pretty feet are on the mind.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm. But that also was after Laris was like starting to like stare at her super creepily, so I think it might have been after he may have already made that
suggestion. I mean,
for payment.
She clearly wasn't into it, and because it did that really big close-up of her being like, oh Christ, all right, get it over with, kind of type of thing.
No, she was just doing it for information and to get it over with, I guess.
Also, it does kind of harken back to what Rhaenyra's was saying when it's like talking about basically living her life in service to men, right?
Right. Yep.
And it's like she is, Alicent is basically, as much as it's easy to hate her, is trapped inside a prison. You know, you got Otto Hightower, who's basically been like priming her for her for where she is her entire, you know, well, until since she was very young. You've got Viserys, and now you've got Laris. And that's not even mentioning like Aegon, who probably, you know, like gives her a fair amount of grief. And now that he's king, he's going to like be a little Joffrey, really, isn't he? Right?
Yeah. Kristen Cole is wrapped up with Alicent too, and he's like, every chance he gets, he's defending her honor by killing people.
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting interaction with
Rest in peace, Lord's Beeper.
Yeah, right. Like he just hit his head, so it's like, oh my God.
So in the book, there's a couple different accounts on how Lord Beesbury dies. Because it's based off of different like fake sources. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping that he'd get thrown out the window, because that's what one of the characters says, that Kristen Cole throws him out the window. But
forward for that particular murder is the Targaryen the green children. They've been trained by Chris. We've had that established, and in the last episode there was a point where Aegon pushed Lucerys's head into the table when they started the fight at the end of the dinner. Like, just again pulling forward, pulling back. It's interesting, like foreshadowing, and like just again deep visual character building. Like there is a clear something to like Crispin's advice was like, don't let them get up. And so if you've got someone in a vulnerable position, you push them down. It was interesting tactics that they duplicated, where one person who was trained by one pushes another into the table and the other one does the same thing to kill him. So unintentionally, it would seem, but he's, you know,
I was surprised because I was expecting the knife. And I was also expecting Kristen Cole to have become, I suppose, more visibly different, really.
Do with some, like, white frostings or something, just to make him a little bit older looking.
Yeah, like, but
he really isn't.
Like, dyes eyebrows or something.
Yeah,
Rhaenyra's trained actresses. Like, he needs to get some greys.
Yeah, something like that. He'll be a bit grizzled or have some scars or something like that. He looks the same as he did when he started the show. And, like, you know, and there are characters that are in their 20s now that haven't been born when he was introduced, right? I mean, how old is Kristen Cole? He's got to be like 50.
I'm like 40, maybe.
He definitely doesn't look 40.
Yeah, because Rhaenyra was like meant to be 15 or so when she first met him, and he was probably meant to be like early 20s, and she's meant to be like mid 20s, early 30s now, right? So
yeah, she should be in her 30s now, so he's like late 30s.
He's not like crazy.
Not
old.
A chance. Aegon's 20 years old.
Yeah, but Aegon,
I think he's like 19 or something.
Let's say 20 to make it easy maths, right? So we know that Kristen Cole has been, he's been a Kingsguard for over 20 years. So at the beginning, at episode one, he looked at least 25, if not 30.
Yeah, but you know, if we're saying actors look the age they're meant to look, then we'll be slightly confused about Aemond and whether or not he looks older or younger than he ought to be. So I think there is some imperfections with the casting and some imperfections with all the time jumps as to actually aging up the characters.
I think they've done a pretty good job on the whole. They've done
a pretty good job, but they could do with definitely putting some greys in Kristen's hair.
Yeah, I think like they dropped the ball with Kristen a little bit, but maybe he's the problematic heartthrob.
Yeah, well, talking about heartthrob and him, there was that interesting line from Alicent. She was saying, where's my notes on it? She was saying to him, I've lost it. Where is it? Oh no.
Lost it, Jenny. You've lost it. Find it. Don't panic. Find it.
she said something along the lines of like, for the loyalty you owe me and your love of me as your queen to Crispin. And so, there seems to be definitely something going on between them. And there was the way that was framed was very intimate and very romantic.
So I don't know
whether or not there's some sort of like. Mm. I think because they're both prudes, I think there might be like a
there's a
sexual tension.
I would say it's more of an anti-sexual tension, right? Like it's like they're having a prude off, like. Because when Aemond and Kristen were knocking on the door of that brothel, Kristen said something like, "Every mother is the something of the lady."
No, every woman is the image of the mother.
Yeah,
that's the one. That's the one. So
should be treated with reverence or something.
Yeah. And, like, Kristen obviously has, like, his own personal demons, albeit somewhat maybe blown out of proportion. But, like, he's got his, like, he probably has some weird, you know, incel guilt about, Neera. And she and Alicent probably has quite a lot of guilt about, like, I don't know, the weird sex that she has to do. With old men and Laris's thing, and you know, like she's not happy. Yeah. Like she's like, you know, so she probably does find a fair amount of solace in religion. Although, of course, as we know from Game of Thrones, Cersei used religion as a power base, and Alicent could arguably be using that as a, you know, like a legitimizing tool. But also, like I think she probably. Quite finds a lot of protection in religion, or like a lot of like comfort in it, because it's like a place away from being used for sex.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple of threads that I could pull from this particular conversation. So, I think she is a true believer in the faith, and that is a comfort to her. And it is kind of, you know, it's one of the things she used to kind of hoist herself up when she's having moments of doubt is, you know, the mother or these different gods will support me because I have been there. I wonder if ever there'll be something that happens that actually breaks her faith, but I don't think that will happen anytime soon, but maybe. But one of the interesting things I was thinking about is I've talked about this before, where she is the master of speaking hollow, hollow tropes and hollow kind of phrases that people say. Platitudes, like hollow platitudes about, like, I'm sure she'll make a good, like, I'm sure a good and kind queen would do you good, and I'm sure she's a good and kind queen because that's the thing you say about other ladies. I'm sure, like, the queen's duty is to the people. And actually, when you break down, like, she keeps saying we've got to protect the people. We've never actually seen Alicent interact with anyone of the lower classes except for her maid. In this episode, we found out that her maid is spying on her.
Yeah.
So I think there's going to be a real turn where the only people who are not high class people that she's interacted with. So all the time she's said this kind of hollow platitude about, like, we must do it for the people. The people would want this king, or the people, we must protect, like, the people want Aegon, or, you know, we've got a duty to prevent war for the people. They all seem very hollow platitudes. And I think now that the only lower-born people that she's ever interacted with was a poor girl who got raped. by her son. Potentially in the future.
So she gaslit into saying that it was that she tempted him.
Talking about using religion and femininity as a weapon, that was vicious. Her serving maid, who has, she now has the information that she has betrayed her. I'll be interested to see how she treats underclasses going forward, particularly now Otto has agreed, in theory, to actually maybe take a stand regarding the most desperate poor of King's Landing. I'll be interested to see whether or not Alison stands against him on that now that she is standing against him, or whether or not she will continue with the empty platitudes and say, yes, of course, we'll help the poor, blah.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, that was a bit of a tangent, but it was connected to what was being said.
No,
she definitely uses femininity and she uses religion as weapons.
Yeah.
She never wears armor, but she does wear dresses. She wears the equivalent of power gowns. Power suits. You know what I mean? Like there's something about the cut of her dresses that are very just like, I'm coming in.
Yeah.
Do business.
Business. Lady Anthony, businesswoman. Yeah, for sure. But she still seems riddled in fear as well, right? Or like discomfort, or like she is doing for all the weapons and underhandedness she's doing. There's like, you can't help but think that underlying it all is because she has a potential challenger to the throne. Rhaenyra's just going to at some point kill her.
Yeah.
Which sort of implies that, like, basically, and I can imagine it being, and so if they make the first move, basically it's like they're only at war because they think the other side wants to kill them. It's, you know, like that's the tragic thing.
Game theory.
Yeah, exactly. Or yeah, exactly. So what I found particularly interesting was that Rhaenyra's actually talked to Alicent and says, don't you ever imagine yourself on the Iron Throne? And I'm kind of interested what does she mean by that?
I have a theory, and I think it's an abstract one that I don't think anyone else in this current conversation might have thought of.
Okay. Lay it upon us.
I think that, you know, there's the meme of Alicent, which is the very face of someone who's never had an orgasm. Have you seen that meme?
Yeah.
It's a picture of Alicent as like the very definition of someone who's never had an orgasm. I think that Rhaenys was using the metaphor of visualizing yourself on the Iron Throne as having had like liberation, like feeling like you are in control of the situation, or like having that moment of like having an orgasm, basically. Like it was asking her whether or not, like, I think Alicent has got, she's got good religious, and she's inside, like, she's got good, like, she's been educated, she has good insight, like, she has great feminine, like, she knew exactly all of Rhaenys conflict and all of the stuff that she's been going through, and she's clearly been aware of Rhaenys' issues and saying, you should have been queen, like, your husband has been pushing for this, isn't it terrible, you should have your right to your daughters and all this stuff. She is really, like, she's not stupid, she has she's good insight, she has good upbringing, she has good training to be a political leader, but she has no imagination, and that's part of the reason why she speaks in these platitudes. It's part of the reason why she is guided by everything that goes on. She has no imagination, she has no concept of actually breaking the walls that she exists in. Like, she lives to serve this patriarchy and to just continue as she is. And Rhaenys was saying, like, you don't want to, like, you don't want actual freedom, you just want to have a window in your box. You want to be able to look out the window.
Oh, that was such a good line.
Yeah, that was a good metaphor. Yeah, like, you just want a window.
Oh, it was
Yeah, but she doesn't want to make... But even if the window was there, she doesn't want to take it, or she doesn't want to make her own window, because she's in so much duty to everybody
exactly.
else.
Exactly. But if you were to take the conversation, the phrasing of the words, have you ever visualized yourself on the Iron Throne? And then change those words to, have you ever had an orgasm? And replayed that scene... It would be exactly the same reaction.
kind of like her imagination isn't even strong enough for her to get her own self there by herself.
Yeah, she wouldn't even have thought of it. Like, she's a proper lady. She wouldn't even thought of that.
So she's basically, it's basically like saying that she's just a tool for everybody else to use, basically, because she has no imagination for herself.
Yeah, she's got no imagination, and she's got no, like, in the same way that I don't think Alicent's ever genuinely never thought of herself on the throne, she's never had the experience of thinking, I could be that, ever. It's not even passed over her conscious mind or even her subconscious mind. And that look of, like, kind of embarrassment that she has when, and, like, pity that Rhaenys has, where she looks at her and she's like, oh my god, this poor girl has never thought, ever.
Like, it's basically like, have you ever thought about
enjoying her own life?
Yeah. Have you ever thought about what you want instead of basically giving whatever being used by everybody else?
Yeah. So, like, for me, that read as a, have you ever actually had an orgasm? the reactions and the way that they played off each other in that scene, and the fact that Rhaenys looked at her with such pity, like such genuine pity of like, oh my gosh, this poor girl has never actually experienced the basic decencies in life, and therefore has never thought that she is owed them because she's never experienced them. And I just thought that was kind of that's the way I translated that scene.
It's like she's not living at her full potential of what she could be doing, and that was kind of a jab at Alicent.
Yeah, and like, I think it, maybe not a jab, but like a kind of trying to make her realize it. And I think by the end of the episode, she kind of, because she has that interaction with Otto, where like after having that conversation with Rhaenys, where she's like, I know you've been like, and I think I also put that in a different podcast where I was like, at some point she might actually realize that Otto's been manipulating her this whole time. And after having that conversation with Princess Rhaenys, she actually has that conversation with her father where it's like, you've been using me. Yeah. I think her imagination has been opened up, and I'm really interested to see. I had that chuckle. I don't know. That's just how I read that scene. I found that like, I don't know if that's just me, and I kind of want to discuss that scene with another woman and see whether or not I translated that in the same way, because I don't know whether or not it's just my brain being weird.
It's like Rhaenys is saying, like, well, I was in this position and I got denied, but you're in this position and you could get what I was unable to get. So I wonder if that's like...
And you haven't even thought of it. Like, right, that, I think exactly. That's, she's flabbergasted, like, that this adult woman...
Is it like a shaming of Alicent, though? I don't know if it's like trying to make her feel ashamed at all, or maybe guilty for not doing what she could.
I don't think it's so much shame as I think it's trying to figure each other out. And I think like Alicent had really good insight into exactly what Rhaenys' issues were and all of her conflicts leading up to this point. Like she lays it out plain, and then Rhaenys hits back with trying to figure out what Alicent's deal is and realizing that Alicent has never even contemplated thinking for herself.
This is a weird one, and I don't know if it would work, right? But if Alicent decided to go Super Saiyan in a metaphorical Game of Thrones sense, right? Could she groom Aegon so that he would detest sitting on the throne so much, because it looks like she's practically there, to the point where she could convince him to actually just make her the queen? Can that be done? Can the king do that?
No, I don't think that could happen. I think the whole conversation, from my interpretation of it, was more of that when she said, can you ever imagine yourself on the Iron Throne, that she wasn't so much talking about Alicent herself, but as couldn't you envision a woman on the Iron Throne at all? That Alicent by default is just sort of going along with what the men are in her life are telling her to do. And she's like, we have the opportunity to put a woman on the throne. Because like immediately before in that conversation, Alicent says to her, she says, you should have been queen. It was denied for you. And like, I think what Rhaenys is thinking from that moment on is like you're being such a hypocrite by saying that. That makes you a giant hypocrite by, you know, if I was the one that was rightfully the heir, then it should be Rhaenyra now. So,
yeah,
that's how I took it.
I think it all feeds into it's a conversation between two women about a very simple subject, but the subtext is very, very deep. And it comes into, again, like, could you picture a woman on the throne ever? Like you've literally just said that we can't, you should have been queen, but we can't govern. We have to help the men. We have to usher them gently. I think she literally uses the term usher them gently, and that's very, again, weaponized feminism, but not actually empowerment. Like Rhaenys is saying, have you never thought about actual empowerment? Have you never thought about the concept of actual freedom? You just want to be able to be less trapped, and you're not thinking about pushing down walls at all. I thought it was a really, like, probably one of my favorite scenes of the series so far, in terms of, like, a lot of dirty laundry was aired, and I think there's a lot of great subtext.
Quality dialogue. That's what I, you know, like, it was, that's the kind of, like, height of the Game of Thrones kind of conversational, you know, level. That's a little bit of Varys and Littlefinger type of thing, you know, where it's... Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it's some, like, they have these conversations from time to time where they just talk about what the show is about, and I kind of like that. But she's not having it, is it, Rhaenyra's? Like, she, like you say, probably sees hypocrisy there or sees bullshit. But also, actually, what I did find particularly interesting in this episode is the two Erics, or Arik and Eric, as they probably should be called.
The twin theme.
Yes, because I heard in
the blurb.
The blurbs, that the Dance of Dragons had brother against brother, and I think, oh, that's kind of interesting. I didn't expect it to be like that, but like... Oh, yeah, I suppose the Cargills might very well be. Because, like, the thing is, like I get why they want to end the child fighting pits, because that was gnarly. Yeah. That was just...
Oh, my goodness. What is this, like, Fight Club for children, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And did you notice they were blind as well? They blinded them, sharpened their nails and sharpened their teeth.
Yeah, they did, because they were, like, not attacking each other very efficiently, which makes sense.
You don't think that, like... How is that can't be legal, can it? Like,
they grab the gold cloaks.
Well,
they
bribe the gold cloaks.
This is half the dragon.
Yeah.
It's against the law of the land, but the whole point is the gold cloaks are a corrupt force that can be bribable. And so even the
if Daemon were still in charge, this would never happen.
Yes.
Bring
back Daemon. Yeah, he would never let this happen. This is what, because, like, who is head of the gold cloaks? There was someone.
It was someone on the small council, right? I forget.
Let's see. Small council. The small council, right? Well, it says here the small council consists and/or consisted of Grand Maester Melos, Grand Maester Orwyle, Jasper Wild. I think he's the new one. Lyman Beesbury. Rest in peace. Yeah, it doesn't say he's dead here. Although it also doesn't... Yeah, it says that Grand Master Melos is dead. It doesn't say... They need to update Beesbury. Tyland Lannister.
Or is Lannister Master of Coin?
I think Lannister's Master of Coin.
Isn't he Master of Ships?
Oh, maybe. Beesbury
was Master of Coin.
That's about right. That sounds about right. Maybe, yeah. What's Jasper Wild then? Is he Master of Laws? Okay, it says
he would be then the default head of the gold cloaks?
Well, head of the gold cloaks. I'm sure there was someone that was named.
Well, the city. I don't think that, well, like, Daemon was the head of the gold cloaks, but he wasn't on the small council, right?
Historically, it was Harwin Strong who wasn't on the small council.
Oh, I think. Yeah. Am I not right in thinking that the head of the gold cloaks is a small council position?
No,
it's not.
Remember,
Otto put Daemon in that position specifically so he wouldn't be on the small council.
Yes,
or exactly. Something.
Yes, I am confusing it with the head of the Kingsguard, who usually, but not always, sits on the small council. Because
speaking of the head of the Kingsguard,
But in Game of Thrones, Barristan Salmi did not sit on the small council because he also served for the Targaryen king, and it was considered a conflict of interest or a, you know, unsafe thing to do, right? But like, Harold Westling, he kind of sits on the council, right? Or stands in the corner.
Yeah,
I think they are meant to be more security than input. Although I will say, he's pretty
badass in this episode. He just like, he's like, I'm out. And no one stopped him. No one even tried.
Well, I like the echoes to the Game of Thrones main series. It was very reminiscent of Barristan Selmy's taking off his white cloak, saying, "I refuse this corrupt government. How dare you?" Although that was more an insult on his honor, rather than, I suppose, he perhaps would see the it being commanded to go and kill Rhaenyra as an insult on his honor. Obviously, it's kind of interesting you put Kristen, who's saying, who literally immediately snaps to killing Beesbury because someone insults the queen, and they then order him to go and kill, like, the commander of the Night's Watch to get some dragons and go kill the heir to the throne.
Yeah,
and he is so insulted he just leaves. It's a different way of taking that honor system of like, someone's insulted the queen versus I've literally been commanded to go kill the heir to the throne. I'm not. So it's interesting parallels between him and Barristan Selmy, and like the respect for the cloak and how they treat their cloaks. And like the fact that it starts off with if we're going with brother of the Kingsguard facing off with a brother of the Kingsguard, and then literally later on have brothers of the Kingsguards facing off with each other, and one of the brothers taking the other side. So if we're taking the brother v brother thing, we've had like the there's like an Aegon and Aemond facing off with each other. Like there is a brother. Jason, like, there is not a brother here that hasn't fought.
Aemond and Viserys. Yeah, Otto and his brother.
Yeah. Aemond and. Yeah, just all of the brothers don't get along.
Except, of course, the strong boys. I mean, sorry, the Velaryon boys. Oops, don't you drop
it. Oops. Oh, your tongue for that.
Oh.
Well, you didn't say proud.
Something really bad's gonna happen to them because they're kind of like. I don't want to say they're like likable because there are some things about, I think it's Jacarys, that like the fact that he's like so easily like wound up kind of like not bothers me, but it's like, chill, dude. Like,
well, it's like he'll do that so many times before somebody else pops him, you know?
Yeah.
He needs someone who is not his mother to sit him down and have a conversation and be like, don't rise to it. Like, true or not. Don't rise to it. Like, you're just going to make it worse.
They're doing it because you rise to it. You're playing into their hands.
Yeah, like, sometimes you just have to say no to the bullies.
Shrug it off. Yeah, it's like,
as Taylor Swift tells you.
Shake it off. Yeah. I would be interested to see how they develop as fighters, because obviously they're sort of penned at the moment as, like, being a bit soft. But, you know, if this show has taught me anything, it's these things can come around, right?
I'll be interested to see how they go. I mean, it's interesting that what's the name of the older brother? Oh my gosh, I'm the guide.
Eric.
Jacarys. Jace. I should just call him Jace.
Is it Jacarys and Luceris, or is it Jacarys and
Luke? Jace and Luke.
Jacarys and
the fact that Jace is a dragon rider, but does not fluently speak Valyrian at whatever age he is, like 14, 15? Is like, is that meant to be a Jaime Lannister dyslexia thing, or is that meant to be a he's not a true Targaryen type thing? Like, there's something like Rhaenyra seems like a good mother who is dedicated to, like, at least, even though she doesn't like the birthing process, dedicated to the upbringing of her children and loves her children dearly. And yet, even though she's so proud of her Valyrian heritage and, like, literally had a blood marriage to her uncle, seemingly has not taught her sons Valyrian? Like, they're a bit old to be learning. I would think, like, she would be speaking them, like, Valyrian to them since babies, or at least since they got their dragons. They've had dragons for 10 years.
That is interesting, because I did at some point propose the hypothesis that that there was no magic bonding between people and dragons, but it was really just that only a small handful of families knew Valyrian, and thus it kind of presented itself as magic or mystical. But yeah, like as you say, if Jacerys, Luceres have dragons and their Valyrian is, well, actually, you don't need extensive Valyrian, because Daenerys in Game of Thrones didn't have like hugely extensive Valyrian, did she?
No, she was fluent.
Oh, she was.
Yeah, fluent. The people of Essos, of the former like Valyrian Empire, speak like a dialect of Valyrian. It's not the same like as High Valyrian. It's like, you know, like French to like Latin. So
yeah,
there's some knowledge of Valyrian out there.
Okay, what was she learning? Was she learning in season one, Daenerys, that is? Was she learning
Dothraki? She's learning Dothraki. Yeah.
She always spoke Valyrian, because there's that wonderful reveal in, I think, season three of Game of Thrones, where she has that whole thing where she's trying to buy the Unsullied. Mm-hmm. And the slave master is being really, really rude to her, and Missandei's like translating politely and being really diplomatic. And it turns out Daenerys understood everything he said and everything that Missandei said. So that's why she became really connected with Missandei, because she knew that Missandei A was like incredibly multilingual, and B, Missandei had really good political insights to be able to politely translate everything that he was saying and then reword it. But then she also got the like, I've been speaking Valyrian my entire life. I'm Blood of the Dragon. Mm. Also, Jacaerys.
She also probably had a degree of like solid sisterhood empathy kind of thing by being under, like, because they were both maltreated by.
Yeah, the slavery connection, 100%.
Yeah, but you know, like by men in their lives and stuff like that. So.
And thus the theme continues.
I don't know. Do you think there's still any possibility or at least deliberate ambiguity that it's just the politics of the Valyrian language that might lend dragon riders to be dragon riders, as well as, of course, like, you know, other things like developing homes for the dragons and manipulating the supply of dragon eggs and things like that? Because you don't want anyone having a dragon. You can't have anyone having a dragon. What if the commoners have a dragon?
Yeah, well, I will put this forward, which is a really straightforward argument from Octius Flex, which is, when you're on top of a dragon and they're flying at full pace and you're yelling commands at them, there's no way that a dragon would be able to hear a human yelling.
Yeah. You kind of suspend some disbelief a little bit, you know? So you'd be yelling, you open your mouth and just air
dragons. Dragons have got incredible perception, or there is some set of psychic or magical linkage between dragon riders and
their dragons. Would you be able to use something else, like whistles or like touching on their head or something in their neck to lead them? I don't know.
I'm sure there's some sort of, like, well, hopefully the series will explore it. I'll be interested to know more about the dragon lore, because we had, you guys seen the Next Time On clips or next episode?
Yeah.
House of the Dragon. Because there's that scene with, so Daemon is singing Valyrian, presumably to a dragon, and that's interesting. Like, singing to a dragon in Valyrian is like dragon taming, dragon coaxing, which, as far as I know, the default is one dragon, one rider, and dragons tolerate other people who can speak Valyrian because they're intelligent beings. But I'm interested to see what he's doing singing to a dragon, whether or not that's trying to coax a wild dragon or trying to, I don't know. It's just like talking of like dragon lore that's yet to be fully explored. That's a new thing.
So Who do we think's going to be? Who do we think's going to be on the Black Council then? Oh, I think we can see a few people, and I don't recognize any of them. So I think we may get introduced to a number of new characters.
What's interesting is they had that line, which is like, if we're going back to Viserys not being very good at actually making sure that his ruling regarding secession actually has any weight to it. He never actually, since Rhaenyra was 16, he has never called together the lords to make them re-pledge their loyalty to her, particularly after Aegon was born. He should have done it as soon as Aegon was born. He should have brought back all the lords, got them to re-pledge to Rhaenyra to make sure she sticks the landing. Like, that was his wish, to make sure it's like set in stone, get all the lords to pledge to her. He could have done that any time in the last decade, and he didn't. And they made the point in the council that, like, half the lords that pledged are now dead. Like, it's been 10 years. And then the lords that did bend the knee, they were, like, lower lords. There wasn't any, like, Baratheons or Arryns or Starks. Was there a Stark?
There was a Stark in there. Yeah, because he doesn't look like a Stark. I think he's got, like... I mean, it looks blonde in the video, but I think it might have been just grey.
Okay, well, like, I feel like they would have drawn more attention if it was an actual, like, I suppose they don't swear by their houses.
I think they did say the name Stark at some point.
They did, so House Stark did pledge to Rhaenyra way back in episode one.
Yeah.
But they weren't one of the ones that, so they had those lords pledged to Rhaenyra in episode one, and then in this episode they had the lords who were happened by default to be in the Red Keep at the time of the king's death to bend the knee, and most of those lords are like lower lords, so it'll be interesting to see once we get to the Black side, see which houses, which of the important houses go to which side, because we're assuming Lannisters are going to be with Greens, because they've got what's he called on the council. And obviously the High Towers will be with the Greens. That's blatant. Mm-hmm. But like where the Starks pledged to Rhaenyra, that was 10 years ago. So it's the North remembers. I assume the Starks will be on Team Rhaenyra, Team Green, Team Black.
What
about the Arryns? What about the
Arryns? Wasn't that what? I might have been confused, but Tyrells. Was that the woman? The woman lord, the lady that didn't bend the knee in that scene, was she was the lord of the Lady of the Eyrie. Oh, she was House Fel. Okay.
Yeah.
I do know that the current like leader of the Eyrie is a woman, in Arryn.
So, Lady Jane Arryn, who is the Lady of the Vale and technically owns her loyalty to Daemon, I believe, because Daemon was married I don't know whether or not, because he, like, the cousin potentially was spreading rumours that Daemon murdered his wife, whether or not Jane will actually concede loyalty to Blacks, or whether or not she'll go, well, you killed one of my bannermen, wife, kinslayer. I don't know, I'm really interested to see which of the High Lords for the actual, like, kingdoms go for which sides. That's not decided yet. And I'm also going on that from that scene. Lord Craswell does not make a good spy. Like he gone die. He was going to die the moment he was like, "Oh, I hesitated. Oh no, I'm totally safe." Like he should have come up with.
He didn't come up with like an excuse.
Anything.
Yeah.
I've got a sick mother.
I left the stove on.
Yeah. Too much excitement. I need to visit the Street of Silk. Like, anything, Craswell, anything.
I know. Oh. He was...
He's just a very bad spy.
I suspect, because I think the only two lines of dialogue he had prior to that was basically, you know, pro Rhaenyra, right? So I think it was probably like the writing was on the wall that it was, they just decided to kill him.
Yeah.
And...
I think it was also to highlight that Varys really does look and listen. So the two things that Laris was seen doing today was he at the point where all of the servants were being ushered into the dungeon so they wouldn't spill the beans, Alicent's handmaid was like, but God, and Laris was like, she seems suspicious. And then later on, it had all of the guys bending the knee except for Cresswell, who then took his sweet time getting down because he was pretty scared and conflicted. And then Laris, like, staring him down. So I think it was meant to highlight that Laris really does watch and look and reads body language and feet language.
Looking for feet.
And, like, pays attention. So I think a lot of that was to highlight his skills as a spy as much as to highlight that, like, what I do want to know is actually the lords that didn't bend the knee, were they also executed or were they imprisoned?
I would like to know this too, because you can't just go around killing lords for not, like, because the thing is, right, it's like king wasn't there, queen wasn't there, no one was there. Right, like, are you going to bend the knee to a hand? You know,
are they going to make good hostages? Are they going to be hostages until their houses come and bend the knee? That would be maybe the more sensible political move.
Maybe,
like,
yeah.
So Cresswell, they can call an oathbreaker because he did bend the knee, but then clearly was going to run off to Rhaemyra. So he can be called an oathbreaker because he said that he was going to bend the knee and then didn't. While the other two who said, we are not oathbreakers, we are going to stay loyal to Rhaemyra, they technically haven't pledged themselves to Aegon, so technically they are not oathbreakers. They are just political hostages. So I'm assuming they weren't killed, because it didn't specify it.
Some people definitely died from that dragon, though, huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got the feeling we're going to have unhappy peasants in the future.
That might not go down well, actually, might, you know, that, Rhaenyra's could have just ended the war there and then, right, just, yeah, and a free barbecue.
Yeah, I think the concept with that is obviously she doesn't want to do kinslaying, she doesn't want to kill people, like, if she makes the first move, then there'll be no war. Again, her conversation with Alicent was also about the idea that if we don't strive for peace, there will be war. So her saying, look, I literally have a rocket launcher pointed at your face. Did I cut out?
Max did.
Okay. She was like, literally, I have a rocket launcher pointed at your face, your Royal Highness, and I'm choosing not to use my massive dragon to kill your entire family. Basically she was holding up the white flag. She was saying, you were going to hold me hostage. I am literally holding the weapon right now. I'm putting up the white flag, and I'm going as a peace envoy, potentially, to Rhaemyra to try and root for peace.
Yeah.
Is how I translated that. Is the, I could kill you right now, but you said you wanted peace. I said I wanted peace. Mm. I'm leaving, and you can't stop me. So let's assume that I'm going to for peace.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, though. Because, like, I was just saying, like, Rhaenys, in terms of secrecy for this episode, like, she was the one that escaped, right? And then did what she wanted and got on the dragon and got what she wanted, but didn't abuse the power. So that's another little parallel there of, like, look at me doing exactly what I wanted to do and accomplishing it and rubbing in your face a bit, but also wanting peace. But look what I did and you can't do because you're, like, you don't want to do what you want. You have no imagination.
Imagine how good of a queen I would have been. Like,
exactly.
I'm the Red Queen, the dragon, and I'm going for peace. I'm not killing you vindictively. I'm not becoming Kinslayer vindictively. I am a badass grandma.
It was a power display.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah, definitely. Like,
interestingly, though, something I just want to throw out there, because I watched the next episode. So the crown, Viserys' gold crown. So Aegon has been given Aegon's crown. Aegon the Conqueror's crown, which is made out of Valyrian steel, has been given to Aegon. Viserys' crown, which was Jaehaerys' crown, has been given, was on his body. That's when we last saw it. And Alicent laid it on Viserys' body, and his body was wrapped in the same gold cloth as baby Aegon was. Just as a nice little pattern notice that I noticed. But yeah, so she left it with the body, and then if you watch the next time on, Rhaemyra is wearing Viserys' gold crown, and I think Rhaenys took it. I think Rhaenys was brought it by Sir Eric. And the reason why, you know, she was holding her cloak really weirdly the whole time when she was running through King's Landing. I think she was holding the crown to her chest underneath her cloak that whole time. I think she's got the crown.
Yeah, I think that's that. Well, yes. I mean, we do see the crown, yeah, in the preview for episode 10. So it definitely gets into Rhaenyra's hands one way or t'other. It's interesting that they use Aegon's crown. I mean, it's for legitimacy, right? Like it's like they're pulling, because he has Dark Sister. Is that what he's waving around in the
Blackfire?
Blackfire.
So
Daemon has Dark Sister.
That's the one. Yeah. So they're using artifacts to further legitimize the. His claim as well. But what I find to be quite interesting is Viserys's crown is the same as Jacarius's, so in some ways you could say that Viserys's crown might have more legitimacy because it's, you know, been worn by the most recent recent number of kings.
Okay. Yeah,
and that's the argument. That's the argument.
And who is considered the best king as well? Jaehaerys.
Was he? I thought Aegon would be like a good one to. He has more like king points.
I think he's like more like a legendary. Like, I mean, he's real person, obviously, but he within the show. But I think that Jaehaerys is thought of as good because he reigned for such a long time over unprecedented peace.
Yeah.
And he was juxtaposed by who came before him, which was Maegor, who was cruel and terrible.
Yeah, I think part of that is, in the same way Alicent went like wore green, like the basically calling the banners for Old Town. I think the message she's trying to send is: we are a powerhouse. We are Old Valyrian. We are prepping for battle. And the message that Rhaenyra is trying to go with is, I am the true heir. I was designated heir by my father. I am actually the queen by the ruling of my father, who is... Like, so I think they're going for slightly different political tacks. And it's political messaging through and through. So it's interesting to see. I'm so excited to see how next episode is. Like, I'm such a sap for the show. It's a problem.
It's a good... I'm glad that they got Game of Thrones back on track.
Yeah,
it's such a test of trust too, with Alicent being the only one in the room when the king died, and everybody trusting her word. Like, you know,
let's say, for example,
they weren't trusting her at their word. The boys wanted to do exactly what they did, and they were just so grateful that Alicent had an emotional. They don't give a tuppence about her emotional reasons.
Oh yeah,
language or,
like. But...
They're gonna do it anyway. They're just like, oh, good. We don't have to convince you.
Yeah, like they've been playing this for ages, and they didn't want to like unsully her with dirty with sully her with like evil like plots. But they
might get
like,
in the way of her woman's emotions, you know.
Yeah, well, they've got enough like planning that they know exactly who they need to take out of the gold cloaks. They know what they're doing with the like they've prepped. Like again, sorry, in terms of. Repeated metaphors. They know what they're doing with the gold. They know what they're doing with the gold cloaks. And they already have the gold heraldry set for Aegon's coronation before Viserys dies. Like, all of it's prepped. They don't have a mourning period. They should have a royal mourning period. But instead, they managed to, in the course of one day, get a crown on Aegon's head.
Yeah. Feel anything?
Yeah, well, considering, like, if we draw a recent parallel, how long is it going to be until the coronation of the current reigning monarch of the UK? Because I've got the feeling it's going to be more than a day.
Well, the coronation is in May next year, I think it's penciled in.
Like, we're penciled in for a full year of, mourning in the modern political spectrum. Like, I feel like they would have
The official mourning period, I think, is it 10 days, 12 days? It's something like that.
Even so, this is like 24 hours and the king is dead, long live the king. Like, they had it planned and plotted. And, like, they're grateful that she's come up with an emotional reason that she'd be along with this, rather than fighting them tooth and nail all the way. But they would have done exactly the same with or without her consent. If that's not a metaphor for the emotional strife of women in this show, God knows what.
I really like the scene where it was just Allison and Aegon talking in the carriage, and she was telling him, she's like, "Oh, your father said this on his deathbed," and he's like, "No, he didn't. Like you're an idiot. Like, do you think I'm an idiot?
Why did he wait so long?
Then? Like, he hated me. Like, this is absurd.
My dad hated me. Like, he thought I was a shit."
That's it. Like, even if I was in Alicent's position, I'd be like, I'm going to need more than a dizzy haze, right? Like, that's kind of like if it's the same thing as like if your dying father was on their deathbed and they're saying I'm leaving all of my wealth to you. I mean, that's not legally binding either, right? You know, it's like,
yeah.
She's willfully believing what she wants to believe. Part of her wants Aegon on the throne. That's as far as her imagination can carry her, and that's what she's been told that she wants since she was 15 years old. Like, since her first baby, her father has been saying, what you want is for your son to be on the throne. What you want is for your son to be on the throne. And she even acknowledges she doesn't even know what she wants anymore to Otto.
Yeah.
So she's been told that she wants this so much that she wants her son on the throne, and part of her just believes that it's, like, you know, there's three Aegons. He could have been talking about Aegon the Conqueror, which he was, or he could have been talking about Rhaenyra's Aegon, or he could have been talking about Alicent's Aegon. And she specifically allows her emotional blind spot to choose the one that she actually wants.
Yeah, you'd think by default most people would just think Aegon the Conqueror, right? Considering that's who, all these new Aegons are named after.
Yeah, well, she's willfully believing what she wants. I think she's deceiving herself, which she's doing on a very deep subconscious level. Like, she's genuinely mourning. Like, there are scenes of her genuinely mourning in this. Because Viserys wasn't a bad man, and she was committed to him for 20 years. So I don't think... Like, before that, he was like a kindly uncle. Like, she did have maybe no sexual gratification from their relationship, but she did benefit from it. You know, anyone you spend that much time in, like, a relationship with, I think she was grieving, and I think she was allowing herself to believe what she wanted to believe.
Yeah.
And she's been told so many things so many times that she sort of believes out of repetition with what people have told her.
Yeah, well, like, she even says that to Otto, which is like, he's like, our hearts are the same, we've always wanted the same thing, and she's like, you don't have any idea what I want, I don't have any idea what I want, you've never known, like, you think we've got the same heart? We don't. Like, no. That was a great scene. I love that scene with her and Otto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah. And, like, the very sentiment of, like, I love, like, as a pacifist... Personally, I love that someone's vocalizing the concept that being hesitant about murder is not a weakness.
Like, yeah.
That needs to be written in stone somewhere in the show.
it's like a dark foreshadowing of things to come, right?
Yeah.
And also something I can imagine her taking a U-turn on.
Yeah. Oh, she's done so many U-turns, hasn't she? She said... she would never let herself be sullied in sex and stuff, but she's letting a man masturbate to her feet. You know, she's paying off rape victims. She's hiding her son's depravity, and obviously, like, again, I don't know how much of it is a lack of imagination, but she's actively choosing to believe that her husband chose her son, and she's actively choosing to ignore the fact that she knows her son is a depraved rapist in order to get on with the day.
Her practice values are definitely not with her aspirational value that she talks about, you know?
Yeah.
Big gap there.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well. How did you guys translate the do you even love me? You're a moron response. Did you guys translate that as she actually believes he's a moron, or did you translate that as actually a mother being like, oh, of course I love you, you stupid.
It's that's interesting. Game of Thrones typical ambivalence, isn't there? Because I was expecting her to say, "You imbecile, of course I love you," or whatever she called him. But also, it's a little bit like, "Oh, silly you," and then like dodging the question. It's like
Yeah.
there's probably a part of her that does love him, but also she understand. She probably does quite understand that, like.
She did put in behind him when she thought that the Red Queen was going to burn them alive. She
That's
stood
true.
in front of Aegon
She
at
did
that
stay in front of
point.
him. Yep. So that's a. I mean, it would have killed both of them, but that does
Yeah, it
show.
wouldn't have made
Yeah, it wouldn't make a
difference.
difference, but she still did it.
Her instinct did hold true at that point.
Well, unless, of course, it was Aegon that hid behind her.
Oh no, she like pushed him behind her, and then
Yeah,
she
I
also
think.
told Crispin to get Helena.
Yeah.
Do you mean Kristen?
Christian, sorry, I keep
Are you calling
calling him Christian.
Kristen? Krispy Kreme.
I have name
Kristen
blindness,
Kreme.
and this show does not help.
He gets into it in the ceremony though. He's like, you know what?
Oh
Maybe I
yeah.
do want to be king.
Yeah, he like slowly warms up to it. He starts like chair. He starts thrusting the sword and getting the crowd to
Yeah,
respond.
this is pretty cool.
I'm scared of how hard he's going to be to control now that he's been crowned, because there was a level of like, oh, this is what love is like, ha ha ha, power. So I've got the feeling I'm very concerned about what he's going to be like as a tyrant king.
Yeah, he really didn't want to be king, and now he knows how powerful he is, now that he's got a little taste of it.
Like,
Yeah,
there's that line.
I do see a little bit of Joffrey in him. M
Yeah.
more than a little bit of Joffrey, if I'm honest. You know what I mean? Like, especially now that he's king and he's got that unfettered sort of unchecked power.
Ego boost.
Yeah. There was that interesting moment where he didn't believe that his father had chosen him until Alicent passed him the dagger, and he was like, don't mess with me, mother, or something. And like, I think at that point he actually believed that his father wanted him to be king, and like the fact that like his mother bowed to him, and his wife bowed to him, and his brother bowed to him. Like, there was, I think he's going to be really dangerous and really hard to control, and Alicent's going to lose whatever fingers that she thinks she has, like power she has over him. Like, gently guide him towards peace.
Yeah,
It
it
ain't going to
definitely took a little
happen.
convincing for him, but now he knows.
Yeah.
Well,
it'd be interesting to see what happens.
Right. For sure. I mean, it's we've got one episode left. And often in episode 9, of a series in Game of Thrones, we would usually expect a battle, but in season 1 of Game of Thrones, there wasn't a battle, although there were some off-screen battles. Although we had a couple of battles. I'm saying battles a lot. Yeah, we have had a
Yeah.
little we have had some little battles. We've had
We
more
had the
battle
Stepstones.
violence.
We had
Yeah,
the Stepstones
Stepstones.
battle.
So
But
yeah, I suppose half of the course, especially if this is going to end up being a 4 or 5 season show, which I think I've read somewhere that it's looking at being. They've already commissioned season 2 because I think what they wanted to do is like, you know, get, I mean they often have these things on ice ready to go even before the first season's aired because like to be honest, like producers know if a show's good. Like they knew The Mandalorian was going to be good, even though. Like it was a relatively new kind of thing that they were doing. Like, you know, you can look at it, you know, right?
Well, I got enough
Like,
hype around it and support that it's gonna be
yeah.
good.
So, yeah, but like, so they've commissioned. So this is almost certainly going to go the distance. I've seen nothing but great reviews so far. Like, people were saying like their least favorite episode of the season's getting like 8s and 8.5s and stuff like this. It's like, yeah, that's
Wow,
fine, you know.
pretty good.
It's
Pretty good.
about as good as it can be, you know. Like realistically, I would love to have a bit more comic relief, and I suspect we will see that in season 2 because that's quite a widely held criticism, right? And a mild one at that, but it is quite dour. I
I
don't
mean,
know
they got
how
to get
fun.
people hooked in a little bit before they do some comic stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is because the source material is quite like it's. Different, you know, the source material is different in form, then it doesn't naturally like it's it doesn't naturally lend itself to as like characters that aren't essential and all that kind of stuff. But you know, I think we can. I would be mildly disappointed if they didn't take that one on board, because I think a lot of people could have appreciated a bit of levity. But I'm going off on a tangent here. What I'm trying to say is episode 10. Now, obviously, they're not going to wrap up the entire Dance of Dragons in one episode. This is obviously like season one's a prequel, basically, or like a prologue is probably more appropriate. Mm-hmm. And now I suspect that like we've seen the characters age up, we've seen them grow up, we've seen who they are, we've seen their backstories, we know what their motivations are, except Laris, because I refuse to believe it's just feet.
It says cover motivation.
I don't know. Like, maybe. At least with Varys in Game of Thrones, like he had a more benevolent interest, right? Even though he didn't have a family or didn't care for one. But like Laris, feet. Is that it? Is that worth killing your family for? I mean, it's not like he couldn't do feet elsewhere.
The Queen's feet, Chris.
There are probably places on the Road of Silk, the Street of Silk. That you can get very good feet there, you know?
Yeah,
but not clean. Attached or unattached.
It's real desperate now for something.
There's probably places on the Street of Silk that specialise in that kind of thing as well, right? Like, it's not, you know?
Do you think he's going to be an arch villain? Do you think he's got a soul motive?
I want... The thing is, I hope this is a red herring. And that he does actually have a better motivation than that, because it's just disappointing, really. I kind of like my like for him as a character kind of just faded away, you know, in one sad wank. You know, it's like,
what, you don't like feet, Chris?
I'm not. Okay, there's no judgment on what you're into, but like if that's your driving force in life.
Yeah, that's pretty low. That's pretty low, honestly.
It's like, it's not worth killing your family for.
He should just go look at some pictures.
Sorry, it's not worth killing your family for. Just, oh.
Yeah, right? After all that effort, what a low expectation after all that effort he put into taking out his family. To honor them by...
And, some feet. Yeah. And it's like, it was clever.
He's quite low to the ground. That's
low expectations. The lowest.
And it's like, you know, there was a time when it's like, oh, he could be quite clever. And I think he's only got one trick. And the first time he does that trick, you think, oh, that's clever. But now he's just burning things down. It's like, I can burn that down.
He's got another trick up his trousers.
Well, some people just want to burn
it. I can burn it down.
Maybe he's
right. He's a firefly. I get it. Oh my god, that's why he's a firefly.
Firefly.
So he's not really a master of whisperers. He's just your garden variety arsonist with a logo.
Exactly. He's a foot fetish arsonist firefly.
He's my new favorite character now.
Foot fetish arsonist firefly.
Oh, disaster.
I'm excited to see what happens, even if it's just information on that.
Oh. I was going to say, it's so much needed relief, and I feel like I need to specify comic relief.
We had a lot more comic relief in this episode than the whole first season of the show.
Yeah,
you really trod new ground here.
Oh.
Oh, where's all the Laris memes about feet? There's gonna be so many.
Oh, there will be. There will be. I'm sure there will be.
Oh goodness.
Billions. Oh my gosh. Do you think that was what Helena was going on about with the centipede with all the feet?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Oh.
Something's afoot. Like,
the centipede has 1,000 feet, and that's what Laris has been up to this whole time. 1,000 feet.
So I, yeah, so I don't know. Like, I suspect when it comes to episode 10, I hope we get some kind of like, you know, some kind of spectacle, before we have to like bunker down for another year, right? At least another year, because they're putting crazy money into this. More money. There's more money gone into this season than in season 8 of Game of Thrones. And okay. I don't really like. Is it just dragons? Are the dragons just that expensive? Is it that drone shot that goes over Dragonstone, which was really nice? But like,
I don't know. I don't know what I don't know if you have you done any comparison cost. On how much money is the cast? Is it the inclusive cast?
The costumes, the production, the sets, like.
And there's a fair amount of green screen in going.
There isn't a huge. The hype. A lot of it is the hype. Feet, the manicures,
the advertising.
Making
people's feet look really good.
Lotion, lots of lotion.
All the socks.
High quality stockings and socks.
Talking of high quality and stockings and socks, though, I did want to give a shout out to the costumes because, like the fact that you can see if you watch really carefully underneath Rhaenyra's cloak that she's put the armor on underneath the cloak. So the moment where Sir Eric turned up, she must have gotten changed in her room and then worn the cloak over her armor that whole time. So that she didn't do like a quick change.
Useful that she did bring armor. Does she bring it everywhere she goes? Probably, right?
I would assume so. Because we've not seen her just ride a dragon. So I'm assuming that given the age she is and the experience that she has, that if she's riding her dragon anywhere, she will probably ride in armor just, you know, for comfort and wind protection at the very least. But I feel like that's a sensible decision. Like when you're at a certain age, you drive with your seatbelt, you ride your dragon with your armor. Like, I feel like that's a...
Yeah, you don't know who you're going to encounter going into
particularly,
a
hall like that. She was going to negotiate to see whether or not granddaughters could get... Driftmark. Like, that's the reason why she's in King's Landing. So, you know, she was going with the intention of doing something a bit politically controversial, so I would bring my armour. Always. I wish, in terms of costumes, though, I wish they'd done something to differentiate the twins. Because for the love, I've rewatched it 3 times and I have no idea which twin was doing what.
Yeah, and, like, the names, it's funny that they're Eric and Eric, but it's just so confusing.
Yeah. I mean, that's Game of Thrones through and through, all the confusing names, but like literally in the scene where they were like talking about the children fighters, like it would have been nice to have one of them have like a different coloured cloak.
Oh, well, I mean, the beard size is yeah, different, yeah, but that's really all you get.
one's pointy beard, one's round beard, right?
I mean, that wasn't enough for me.
To watch again and pay attention to that.
I couldn't tell. Pointing although around. I will say it's not an original Jenny thought, but Ultrafex pointed out that as the season has progressed, all of the small council has slowly got more and more bling going on, where they started off with very little jewellery and now at the point they're out there are big chunky chains. I just wanted to point that out because I, after he pointed out, I was like, oh, that is cool. That's a cool point. Yeah, I just liked it.
We'll see what happens. Cool.
Steering away from the socks, although those stockings were really very nice.
Cool. All right, have we said everything we want to say?
I've got two more things, and then I am done. So one,
left foot is... and right foot, right? Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. So for my left, I will say there's like the whole thing with Aemond and the woman in the Street of Silk.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how much of that is just implying that, like, he has very different tastes to Aegon, and Aegon was just like, yeah, you're 13, get it on, bro. Or whether or not it's something more like the, from Game of Thrones, there was a long-running metaphor of love is the death of duty. So Aegon is really not dutiful, has no regard for training, sword work, like literacy, political training, anything like that, and spends all his time and energy on sex and levity and just doing what pleases him. Like he does what he loves and he has no duty. While Aegon,
do you think when he ranks out of the window, he's trying to hit a seagull?
Maybe that's a very specific thing. think of. Wouldn't put it past him. Put it past Steve.
Sorry, Jenny, I cut you off there with filth. I'll put the filth back in the box.
Sorry. Still kind of giggling about the feet. I don't know where, like, the way that I translated that conversation with the man is that the man was the one who took his virginity. Since then, he was talking about how, like, he was talking that he didn't, like, he was the one that trains with swords, he's the one who's reading, like, he's the one who should be the true king because he's not distracted by things, he does his duty, which to me implies that he might just not be interested in sex or might not be interested in romance, which, given that so much of the political world of Game of Thrones is wrapped up in those things, I'm interested to see whether or not he might be closeted, or it was just an interest, like the way that they did that scene and really highlighted that he was uncomfortable around the courtesan, and how she was clearly aware of who he was. It was an interesting scene. I'll be interested to know more about Aemond, and he seemed very insecure, and we haven't seen him be that insecure since he was a kid.
Yeah, I mean, I took that to mean perhaps a less, you know, far along the line version of that, where he is probably quite intrigued by violence, and, you know, that excites him, and he might very well just be not interested in sex in the same way that Joffrey wasn't interested in sex, and that maybe Aemond was just like, the last time he was there might have been when he was like 13, and he's just a bit like out of his comfort zone, whereas whenever he's like training with swords or doing violence of any kind, like, he's loving it, like he's in his element.
Yeah, he loves it. Yeah,
loves me a bit of violence.
I don't know what that scene was trying to say, but it felt like it was trying to say something very loudly, and I feel like I couldn't quite read it. And the other thing I want to say is there was a line from Aemond again in the same set of sequences where he said, we are decent men with no taste for depravity, to, I'm going to mispronounce his name again, Kingsguard douchebag. Did I pronounce it right?
Christian
Glover.
There we go, that one.
Crispy Cole.
Crispy
Cole. Cole.
Crispin.
He said, we are decent men with no taste for depravity, when obviously we are very well aware that he who is talking to is not a decent man and does have a taste of depravity. And also, I'm interested to see how far Aemond's taste for depravity goes. But also, we had the line from Daemon in a previous episode where he said, all men are capable of depravity. And it was just interesting that those two sentences parallel each other so clearly, coming from Aemond and Daemon, who have very similar looks, very similar vibes, very similar hair, very similar attitudes towards violence and power.
Yeah.
One of them claiming that they are free of depravity, and the other one claiming that all men have depravity, including himself. So I feel like Daemon and Rhaenyra own their chaotic nature, and they own, I'd say that I'd classify the blacks as chaotic good, while I would claim that the greens are perhaps lawful neutral. They're out for themselves, but they are abiding by the laws as written in stone and have no taste for imagination after the laws.
Yeah.
And that's my last point. I'll stop talking. I feel like I've talked a lot.
Although I suppose, like, the term depravity is very much open for interpretation. Someone like Aemond, for example, might not consider violence to be depraved because he was probably brought up, you know, being very encouraged to be good at violence.
Yeah,
so more violence he is, the more he feels like he's fulfilled. Because especially when you're a second son, as it were, like, in terms of the royal family layout in amongst Targaryens, like, a second son might be a leader of an army or something like that, some kind of general. And so Aemond probably, like, in that world, violence is not necessarily seen to him as depraved in the same way that, you know, where, like, but he's also probably brought up to be like, yeah, like, you know, sex is something you do, man and wife, you know, no holding hands outside of marriage, you know. And
well, like, he views Aegon as depraved. Like, he specifically used the words depraved to describe what Aegon is doing, whether it's specifically fathering bastards and going after seeing whores and all that jazz. And Rhaenyra uses the term depraved to describe that Daemon abandoned her and went off and got married and didn't marry her. It's just, it's very interesting uses of the word depraved from very closely, like, parallel characters in very different contexts. So I'll be interested if we see the word depraved come up again, because I feel like it's going to be, I just, the sense of what people perceive as depravity from different viewpoints is, I think, really kind of a way of defining their characters very clearly and concisely, and I just found it super interesting that there is that parallel between all of those individuals on what they perceive as depraved, because it's a very specific word to use. And I'm going to stop talking now because I feel like I talk too much during these podcasts.
No, it's good. It's good.
No, you contribute. You're contributing. That's what we're here to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I've covered all my bits. But
House
that wasn't
Dragon
that
down.
Wasn't
and like that was,
that was
yeah. House and yeah. Dragoned out.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you everyone at home for joining us. Thank you to my fellow hosts, Max, Matt, Jenny, and myself. Thank you myself. It was very nice of you to. I don't. Is Max still with us? He was in and out for a bit.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Yeah, cool. Kinda.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, folks, for joining me. Thank you, folks at home, and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.